made of things which do appear. And for by faith, in Hebrews 11, verse 2, the elders obtained the good report. I want to look now at verse 35 of this chapter, which actually is going to be the verse that we'll use to as our text. Women received their dead, raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance. Why would a man die under torture? Why would a woman die under excruciating torment? Why would they accept this kind of punishment? Well, I think we can say one of two things. Either they could not get out of it, or they could get out of it, but they chose not to get out of it, choosing rather an alternative that was better to them. Now, the text indicates that there were certain individuals who led before the cross of Christ who did not accept deliverance. I think this implies to us that they could have been delivered. We can look at men like Stephen, who, as he was being stoned, could have recanted his faith in Christ, that Christ was the Son of God, and he would have more than likely could have been delivered. We look at Christ, who could have called down legions of angels to save him from the temptations that he faced. And men like Paul, who, when he was in Rome, all he had to do was just say that, well, I'm a Roman citizen. He could have burned a little bit of incense to the emperor, and he could have used his Roman citizenship to escape some of the things that he did. But they chose not to accept deliverance. And why not? In order that they might obtain this better resurrection. But when we talk about the better resurrection, what do we mean? And we all realize that everybody is going to be raised. The Bible teaches unquestionably that everybody will be raised. Paul, in Acts 24, verses 14 to 15, as he was standing before Felix, the Roman governor, he says, well, I preach the same thing as the Pharisees do about the resurrection. Why are they so mad at me? I affirm the same thing that they affirm, and that is that there is going to be a resurrection, both of the just and the unjust. Paul preached that everybody was going to be raised. Jesus in John 5, in verse 28 and 29, also taught the same thing. He says, marvel not at this, for the hour is coming in the which all that are in the grave shall hear his voice, and shall come forth, they that have done good unto the resurrection of life, and they that have done evil unto the resurrection of damnation. So everybody is going to be raised from the dead. And I think sometimes we deceive ourselves into thinking about the fact that we really won't come forth from the grave. In other words, we can do things that are contrary to God's will, and maybe we won't be held accountable for them. Really, the truth of the matter is, I guess, when you get to thinking about you don't have to account for things that you do, you begin to feel like, well, why do I have to hold such a straight line? But the Bible fully affirms that there will be a resurrection in the judgment day. And I guess one reason that we think about this is because year after year that we live, we've seen one body after another placed into the grave. We see these bodies placed into the grave. We know that they're decaying. But yet, we have never seen anybody raised. There is not anybody here with us tonight that has been raised from the dead. There's not anybody walking on the earth today that has been raised from the dead. So we just sometimes begin to think, well, what is there really a resurrection? And of course, we really believe there is, but sometimes it's not fully affirmed in our lives. But when we place members of families or friends in the grave and say goodbye to them, we're saying goodbye for good. That's it. But there will be a resurrection. And the Bible fully affirms this. Now, either the Apostle Paul knew what he was talking about, or he was dead wrong. And either Jesus knew what he was talking about, or he was dead wrong. Hebrews 11, 20, 35 says that there were some that were tortured to death, but they would not accept deliverance. And why? Because they wanted to come out in as good a condition as they could. Not physically speaking, but spiritually. They wanted to be raised to life eternal, not life, full of damnation. And as Jesus said in John the 5th chapter, all were coming out of the tomb. All were coming out of the tomb. Revelation 20 verses 11 and 12 says that the sea will give up the dead in it. Everybody is going to be raised. Once we lie down to sleep the sleep of death, we're not going to lie down for the last time. We will be raised. We will be judged. And when we stand up in front of that judgment, it will be either for damnation or life eternal. One or the other. Either heaven or hell. It won't be anything else. So these people were tortured. They endured some hell here on earth. Why? Because they wanted that good life in heaven. They didn't want the life that is spoken about as being fire and brimstone. In other words, they endured things on this earth so that they might have those good things in heaven. In Philippians 3 and verse 7, Paul enumerates some things here that he had given up in order to become a Christian. Beginning in verse 7, he says, "But what things were gained to me, those I counted for loss. I counted loss for Christ. Yea, doubtless, and I count all things but loss for the excellency of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things, and do count them but dung, that I may win Christ. And he found in him, not having mine own righteousness, which is of the law, but that which is through the faith of Christ, the righteousness which is of God by faith, that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings, being made conformable unto his death, if by any means I might attain unto the resurrection of the dead." Well, what's Paul talking about here in verse 11? If by any means I might attain unto the resurrection of the dead. Was he trying to live a good life in order that he might be raised from the dead? No, this is not what he's saying. He has already spoken in other places, and we've seen that Christ has spoken also that there is going to be a resurrection of the dead for everybody. What he's talking about here is he's going to live as good a life as he can in order that he might attain into that resurrection, that better resurrection, or that resurrection of eternal life. And it would be really a whole lot better in this life to be slowly roasted over a fire than to have to be roasted over an eternal fire in the life to come. Now, the writer here in Hebrews is saying, you people are drifting back into Judaism. You're drifting back into a system that cannot save you. You don't take into consideration the examples of the elders that lived before you, these men that have gone before you and proved by their faith that they are worthy of Christ. So he says, let me refresh your mind a little bit. Beginning in verse 32, as we've read, he gives some examples of men who have lived before, who have suffered and endured hardships. He's already talked about men of faith before this. And he says in verse 32, "And what shall I say more? For time would fail to tell me, for me to tell you of Gideon." Well, you remember Gideon. He fought against the Midianites with only 300 men, and he conquered the camp of the Midianites. And of Barak, you remember Barak the general who served under the under Deborah in the book of Judges? And of Samson, who with two eyes having been put out, killed more men in his dying than he did in his life, having once left what he knew to be right, but humbly returned to God in his dying days. And of Jephthah, the one who promised to God that if he would be giving victory in battle, he would kill the first person that came out of his tent, and that turned out to be his daughter. And of David, I can picture David having wanted to return to the pleasant places in Hebron where he had lived before he moved his capital to Jerusalem, wanting to live that sumptuous life and not being able to, the life which his son Solomon later was able to. And of Samuel and the prophets who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, and stopped the mouths of lions. Daniel, a man who was willing to go and, if necessary, be torn by a beast in order that he might remain faithful to God. And quench the violence of fire, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, thrown into the fiery furnace, who did not even know whether they would be delivered. In Daniel 3, and beginning in verse 16, as they were talking to King Nebuchadnezzar, they answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not give to you an answer concerning this. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Do we have anything like this to face today? Have we ever faced something like this where we would actually lose our lives for the cause of Christ, for remaining faithful to Him, and a especially painful death of being burned alive? These men did not even know whether they were going to be delivered. It says, "But even if He does not deliver us, we still will not serve you, O king." So they were willing to be tossed into this fiery furnace without even knowing whether they would be delivered. But they had faith enough in God that He would deliver them. We go on and it talks about those that escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again. Remember the widow of Zarephath, who Elijah went to? In 1 Kings 17 and verses 8 through 24, "And others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others had trial of cruel mockings." And as we start here in verse 36, I think that the way this reads and some of the things that he's talking about, I think we can say that a lot of this has to do with the period between the Testaments, or the intertestamental period. "At trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, yet moreover of bonds and imprisonment, they were stoned, they were sawn asunder." Isaiah was literally sawed in half, as Jewish tradition tells us. They were stoned. Tradition also tells us that Jeremiah was taken down into Egypt, and when he preached against the people, that they stoned him to death. "They were tempted, they were slain with the sword, they wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and tormented. They wandered in deserts and in mountains and in dens and caves of the earth." We think of Elijah, who after his confrontation on Mount Carmel fled into the desert, there to escape the wrath of the king. But I want to give you an example of some of the severity and cruelty of the punishment, the persecution that went on during this time. In about the year 170, there came to the throne in the area of the Greek Empire, the old Greek Empire, a man named Antiochus Epiphanes. Epiphanes means illustrious, and sometimes it's used in the New Testament to refer to the second coming of Christ. But many of his compatriots and people that knew him called him Epiphanes, or Antiochus the Madman. And I, according to what I could find, never before that time, and I don't know if ever after, there has been a king more cruel than this Antiochus, at least in this area of the world, who ruled over the Jews. But in about the year 170, he went down from his capital at Damascus down to Egypt with the intention of capturing Egypt. And at this time, Rome was a powerful nation, and Rome depended upon the grain supply at Egypt. So Rome, realizing that Antiochus was coming down to invade Egypt, sent one of their senators out and to meet with this Antiochus. And he went out and met him on the seashore, and he told him, if you intend to invade Egypt, then you will fight Rome also. So Antiochus, being a proud man, a king, a very powerful man, also realized that he could not stand up against Rome. So he backed down and began to return home by way of the sea, around the Mediterranean Sea. And he got up to a parallel with Jerusalem. And he said, well, I didn't get this army together for nothing. I'm going to put it to use. So he attacked Jerusalem, and with a short siege, he captured the city. And Jerusalem, at this time, was in no position to defend itself, particularly against a man like Antiochus. And after Antiochus captured the city, or in the process, he killed about 10,000 Jews, a great many by torture. 80,000 Jews were sold into slavery. He invaded the temple, took all of the precious metals and all the precious vessels, and took this as loot. He made brothels out of the chambers that the priests had lived in. He went into the Holy of Holies, which only the high priest was allowed to go into once a year. And there he took a pig and sacrificed it upon the altar, something that at this time was probably no greater abomination to the Jews. And he began a system of Hellenization, or bringing things Greek into the city of Jerusalem and its surroundings. He abolished the worship of Jehovah. He made it criminal law, or a capital crime, only an Old Testament. He made it a capital crime to worship Jehovah. And the people were required to worship Greek gods. Now, one brief story to indicate the severity of the reign of Antiochus here. Some of his servants had gone out into the countryside and had run across a man who even had a Bible and who was worshiping Jehovah. Well, these men, angry at the fact that he was so bold as to do this openly, took this man, dislocated his hands and his feet. They pulled his limbs asunder, fractured his bones. In fact, they just literally tore him apart on a catapult. They ended up skinning him alive. They took his brother, cut his tongue out, and did the same thing to his brother. Now, this was a series of seven brothers. And they got to the fifth brother, and they took him and tied him to a wheel, bending his body around the edge of it. They fastened him with iron fetters and tore him to pieces. The sixth brother they broke upon a wheel while a fire roasted under him. And they took a sharp pit, heated it up, and punctured him so that his bowels just ran out. And we can go on and on. The period that we're talking about just abounds with this type of gruesome literature. And I'm not trying to be gruesome tonight. I'm just trying to get across the point of the persecution that these people went through during this time, the things that they had to endure, and how that they endured these things because there was a better resurrection. But finally, the Jews rebelled under a man named Mattathias in a village of Modin. Antiochus sent some messengers up to them to try to get them to worship the Greek gods, and Mattathias had had enough. And he turned upon these messengers and slew them. And then he took off for the hills. And this began the Maccabean Revolt. And for a brief period, the Jews were independent here, but they lived in caves and dens of the earth, and they wore the skins of animals. So during the Old Testament period, and also during the Intertestamental period, there existed a situation which was, to say the least, very hazardous for a man who honored the name of God. And about the only thing that a Jew at this time could count on was that somebody was out to break his bones, burn him alive, skin him alive, in some sort of manner, persecute him. And in order to remain loyal to the Lord, to Jehovah, a man might very well have to count on dying a very slow death. and that he would have to live in a daily willingness to die that kind of death in order to attain one thing, a better resurrection. And the writer is saying, look back at these people now, and look at the things that they have gone through, and then consider your own situation. In Hebrews 12 and verse 4, he says, ye have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin. So the writer here is saying, I'm telling you that these people who have lived before you in these dreadful times, days when Antiochus roamed the countryside and men like Antiochus just looking for innocent people to do harm to them. And he says, the thing I'm telling you is that you have not yet resisted unto blood striving against sin. And he says you're beginning to apostatize. And why is that so? Hebrews 11, verse 39 and 40 says, and these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise. God having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect. God intended that all along that they should be saved. But back there, they were not made perfect. They did not receive the ultimate promise, the fulfillment, the fruition of the presentation of the gospel. But it was God's intention that they should receive the promise and die loyal and faithful to it. But in our day, he says, the gospel is available. The plan is now known. We can look back through the cross of Christ, whereas they had to look forward to the cross of Christ. They didn't even yet have the knowledge of the crucified Savior. And he says, look how loyal and faithful they were. He says, you who have received the knowledge of Christ, you who have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin, you are drifting backwards. And of course, the application is, press on. The responsibility is yours, to live faithfully in hope of a better resurrection. And I guess it's one thing to read and listen about these gruesome things that went on. And when we think about it in our own situation, it becomes a little unrealistic because we really live in a country today where we have nothing of this sort. And I don't know to what extent it goes on in the world. I'm sure that we're probably lucky in the fact that we don't face this sort of persecution. But I imagine in some places of the world, even today, that there are things like this. But we think of our lives and sometimes think the burden is so great upon us that we just can't bear it any longer. And this is one reason I particularly like this latter part of the 11th chapter of Hebrews. It's because when I'm feeling down or depressed, feeling the weight or the burden of the things of the world upon me, I can look at this chapter and realize that the things that I face today, the things that confront me, are nothing compared to what these people faced back then, at least in physical terms, at least in when it comes to pain and infliction upon the body. We do not face the things that they had to face. And yet, they resisted these things, and they remained loyal to God. And this chapter really gives me comfort when I can look at it and see the situation. Tales are told of men being fried alive in great big frying pans with their children and wives looking on. Sometimes their wives and children even being put in this situation. And all they had to do was just recant the fact that the Lord, their God, was the only God, and say, well, maybe there are other gods that we can serve. That's all they had to do. That's all they had to say. But they endured that kind of thing because they wanted this better resurrection. So look at them, look at these people back there, and look at your own situation today, and compare it, and realize that what we face today is nothing compared to what they faced. And yet, are we living the kind of life that we should? Are we overcoming these temptations that we face? I look at my own situation, you look at your life. Are we living the kind of life, are we standing up for what we believe? Because or not standing up because of what we believe, because of some temptation or some pain or some torment, some persecution comes across our way. And the writer here says, is there any legitimate cause for you to begin to drift back? Is there any reason why you who have not yet resisted, striving against blood, striving against sin rather, you who have not resisted unto blood, striving against sin, is there any legitimate reason why that you can say that you have faced the trials that these people have, and yet these people live through them in the sense that they remain faithful to God, and you are drifting back into the old ways of Judaism, the ways that are not able to save you? And he says, if you are in this situation, well, then maybe you can compare yourself to these people, but you're not in that situation yet. You need to pull yourselves together and to recognize that in order to obtain a better resurrection, it is necessary for one to place his life, everything he has, and is and hopes to be, in jeopardy and in balance in order to ensure that better resurrection. If you're here and want that better resurrection tonight, I suggest you give serious consideration to the hope of salvation that is given in Jesus Christ. In Romans, the 6th chapter and verse 4, it says, therefore we are buried with him by baptism unto death, that like as Christ was raised up from the dead by the glory of the Father, even so also we should walk in newness of life. Have you done this? Have you been buried in baptism with Christ, walking a new life today? If not, the opportunity is being submitted to you tonight, given to you, in order that you might make this commitment to Christ, and that you might begin to serve a life that in the end you might say that I have that hope of a better resurrection. Without it, you don't have a hope at all. And I pray that we'll be making preparation for that final day in order that the first day of our second life will be a good day. If there's anybody here tonight who is subject in any way to the gospel invitation, let them come forward as we stand and sing.
England. Well, I look forward to being here each week, and I trust that we can make these Sunday services together just as meaningful as possible. We made an appeal a few weeks ago to those who are members to try to be absent as few Sundays as possible during the year. We observed that there are the vacations that we all like to take, and certainly this is not out of order. I wish sometimes we didn't have to take them all at once, but I was gone last week, and I can't complain to anybody else. Last Wednesday night, in fact. But I do hope that we'll keep these weekend visits particularly to a minimum, so that we may be as near full strength from week to week as possible for the encouragement that we can give to one another and for what it can mean to the congregation. I had a very pleasant meeting with the German School Road Church in Richmond, which closed last Sunday night. We had the unique experience of nearly doubling the Sunday morning attendance at all the evening services. It's not a large congregation. They run anywhere from 40 to 50 in attendance on Sunday morning, and we averaged very near 90 for each evening of the meeting, all of which meant that the members were there almost 100% every service. And then with the visitors we had from other congregations, very fine attendance was made possible. One brother who had been in digression made confession and came to the truth, and we rejoiced in that. We hoped that other good was done. My family and I had a very pleasant week of traveling up the East Coast. I preached last Wednesday night in Fairlawn, New Jersey, and then we made our way back down by place where Gardner lives and works, and left two of our daughters there. They'll be back, Lord willing, and we hope to be here, as I've said, from week to week, and I trust that our weeks together may be the best we've ever spent. It can be that, and I pray that it will be. There are many books that are published on successful selling and how to make a success in business. There are many courses that are taught on this subject, and many men go about speaking along the lines of success in the business world. I'm sure that much of this can be summarized by saying that if you want to get to the top in business, you push, push, push. You put your business first and everything else second. You sacrifice whatever must be sacrificed in order to make certain that you succeed in this business that you're undertaking. I assume that's what must be said, because that's certainly what it takes. We've observed that on every hand. But someone should raise the question, but what about your family? What about your religion? What about your civic responsibilities? The answer would be, yes, you can use those too towards success. You can use your family to help you succeed. You can use your religious connections to help you succeed. You can take advantage of your civic opportunities, because this is good publicity and this gives you a good image and this helps you to succeed. You see, what the point that is being made is that not that you serve your family or serve your God or serve your community, but rather you use your family and you use your God and you use your civic opportunities and your civic relationships to your advantage, to success in business. Drive. Well, now, our Lord says that the citizen of the kingdom of heaven is going to push. And he's going to put not business, but heaven first. And the kingdom first. And the righteousness of God first. He lays up his treasures in heaven. He makes himself the slave of God. He seeks first the kingdom and God's righteousness. You just can't put both of those things first. You can't put business first and God first. That's exactly what we studied in this portion of the Sermon on the Mount that was studied in our Bible class this morning in the auditorium. Those of you who are not present will remember those words of Jesus, which tell us to lay not up for ourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust corrupt and where thieves break through and steal, but to lay up for ourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through and steal. For he says, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. The light of the body is the eye. If therefore thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of life. If your one consuming goal in life is to serve God, everything else is secondary. All other concerns are put down the line. Then he says, your whole body will be full of life. But if thine eye be evil or confused, if you're looking in many different directions at once, even two at once, trying to attain success in heavenly things and success in earthly things at the same time, then he says, your whole body will be full of darkness. If therefore the life that is in thee be darkness, how great is that darkness? No man can serve two masters. That is, no man can be the slave of two masters. And just as surely as you become the slave of money, then you're no longer the slave of God. But if you're the slave of God, you're not the slave of money. There's a big difference in serving money and having money serve us. It's not wrong to allow money to serve us, but it is wrong for us to serve money. Money serves us when we use it to achieve the things we really want to achieve in life, and that is spiritual all goals and aims. But we become the servant of money when we'll sacrifice spiritual principle, when we'll compromise our character, when we will neglect our family, or when we will put God second in order that money may come first. You cannot serve God and mammon, the writer says. Someone will say, and we all are inclined to say it, but if you don't put your business first these days, you just can't have everything that everybody else has. And you know that's the truth. That's just as true as it can be. But the point is that we as Christians don't expect to have all of the things that other people have, because that is not our goal in life. It's true that we can't have all of the things that other people have, because we have something in heaven that they don't have. You can't have your cake and eat it too, as we have understood for a long time. Some of us want all of this that the world has, and heaven too. But you cannot succeed in that. If you're going to put heaven first, then the things of the earth are going to have to come down the line. On the other hand, if you're going to seek to have all of the things that people have, then you're just going to have to forget about heaven. This idea that we're supposed to have everything that everybody else has is a phenomenon of the 20th century. And it is responsible for the absence of contentment that we all endure. Many years ago, when I was in high school, I heard a man make a talk on a Wednesday night service. He wasn't a preacher, wasn't then, doesn't claim to be now, but he had some wonderful thoughts to provide to offer. And one illustration he used has come back to my mind many, many times across the years. He said, if I go out and open my mailbox tomorrow morning, and I find a $10 bill in that mailbox, I'm going to be thrilled. A $10 bill. How do you suppose this $10 bill got here? Who's been kind enough to give me $10? He said, I'd be happy all day. I'd stick it in my pocket and go my way. If I went back on Tuesday morning and there was another $10 bill in my mailbox, I'd be just as surprised, maybe more so than I was the day before. Well, here's another $10 bill. What about that? Well, who did that? And I'd be happy about it. Wednesday, if it was there again, still happy. Thursday, Friday, every day if it was there, I'd be happy. And if it was there for a month, of course it would be a very, very satisfying experience to take that $10 bill out of the mailbox each day. But then at the end of those 30 days, suppose I go out there and open my mailbox, and there's no $10 bill there. Now how do I feel? You know, I say, well, hasn't it been wonderful that for 30 days I've had a $10 bill in my mailbox every day? $300 I am going to do it. Is that what I'd say? I'd be disappointed. I'd say, where is my $10 bill? I wonder why it was stopped. Have I done something wrong that the money stopped? Maybe somebody stole it out of it. Maybe it was put there and it got stolen. And I'd work myself into a bitter and be very unhappy all day long, very probably. Why? Well, because I've come to expect it, and if I don't get it, then somebody's done me wrong. You know, I had this experience just yesterday. Some time ago, when I was coming into Georgia from South Carolina, I saw the welcome station there, and I stopped at the welcome station, and they gave me a Coca-Cola and a bag of peanuts. I thought that was very nice, you know. And we were coming down the road yesterday and said, let's stop at the welcome station. I said, yeah, we'll get a Coca-Cola and a bag of peanuts. I walked in, got the Coca-Cola, no bag of peanuts. I felt like somebody robbed me. Well, I was expecting peanuts, and that Coca-Cola didn't taste nearly as good because there were no peanuts to go with it. If I never had any peanuts, I wouldn't have expected any peanuts. But the problem in all of us is we're expecting more than we're getting. And as long as you're expecting more than you're getting, you're going to be discontented. There's no way of avoiding it. But if we can learn not to expect so much, and to be aware of the fact we don't deserve anything, then whatever comes our way will be a cause for gratitude rather than a cause for being discontented. We as Christians are pilgrims and sojourners. If you'll pardon another personal illustration, I was with Brother Finney up in New Jersey where I was preaching Wednesday night, and we were walking through a department store there, and here were some very nice reclining chairs that Brother Finney had been pricing and was interested in. And he found one there that had been marked down two or three times, and it was a very fine buy. He said, would you be interested in buying this? I said, well, no, don't think so. I said, we're trying to get rid of everything we can because we're leaving the country. a lot of things that I would have been interested in buying 6 months ago, I wouldn't be interested in right now. It would be hard to make an automobile offer to me that would interest me at all. I've got a couple of automobiles. Anybody want to buy an automobile? I've got a couple of stuff. I'm not interested in buying because I've got to get rid of these things. I'm moving on. And I thought in my own heart that I need to have this kind of a temporary attitude all the time and realize that nothing I have is permanent. It's not wrong, as we'll say in a moment, to make some plans ahead for a few years to come. But we must realize that we're pilgrims, we're sojourners, we get by with a minimum. And these things that mean so much to the world, we just can't allow to come to mean so much to us. And we're speaking, of course, in the main concerning the luxuries. As far as necessities are concerned, everybody needs the same amount, and everybody has the same about the food you can eat, the clothing you can wear, a cover for your head and for your body. We have those things, but it's these luxuries that really cause us to be discontented. It's these luxuries that give us problems. Are they wrong? No, I don't think they're wrong, so long as we keep the proper attitude toward them. I really believe that our luxuries can be used to help us to serve God. I think that two automobiles sometimes can make it easier for me to serve God, and I can accomplish a little more than if I had one. I think sometimes when the house is nice and cool, I can work a little better and prepare lessons a little better and serve God a little better. Maybe show hospitality more readily if I can keep my guests cool. Thanks incidentally for the new air conditioner up at the house. Good way to get that in, I guess. But to come to think that it's a necessity and that I'm being wronged if I don't have it, this is the thing that all of us must avoid. And if we lose them, rather than being unhappy and complaining, we need simply to thank God that we had them as long as we had them and be content. But now, that takes care of luxuries. What about necessities, though? Now we're down to, well, Paul said, food, having food and raiment, let us be therewith content. That word raiment probably deserves a little broader interpretation than that. It actually says food and covering, which probably includes both the covering over our heads and the covering of our body. Food, clothing, shelter. These things are the things that the Bible holds out as necessity. Now somebody says, I know we can get along without luxury, but we're in danger of losing the necessities of life. Have you ever really stopped and thought about the economic condition of this country? Well, as a matter of fact, I have, and I try not to. I try not to think about it. Now, have you ever thought about what could happen to you physically? I thought sometimes, what would happen to me if I lost my voice? I certainly couldn't be a carpenter or automobile mechanic or much else with my hand. What would I do if I couldn't talk? Yeah, I thought about that. But what are we going to do? Are we going to run?